I'll continue with Mills on 26 August 76. So, how much did this large press build cost?
Oh, it's very small, about 10,000 pounds or less. Mm. It was constructed almost entirely in the laboratory, so that it was very difficult to cost. I mean, the labour, the workforce there just worked on it.
Right.
But the external cost was less than 10,000 pounds. And I should have said that there was a little more to it than this building in the first one. I had to convince people that it would work. But there were also a number of basic problems I wasn't quite clear about myself, which I wanted to experiment with, principally on this matter of the intersection of the two arms and what was the best way of dealing with
how they would interact with each other.
So that the experimental model was very useful.
And what about the grading? Was that obvious, how to do that list?
No, that there were several possible ways of doing that, and well, it was just a matter of thinking them out and deciding which, in the end, would be the easiest to make and to maintain.
Maybe this is a good place to ask you about how you went about building something like this instrument. Was it a matter that you sat down and designed it and then more or less supervised the entire construction of it? Or was it a matter of that you were out there with people having fabricated things, but you had to be pouring cement and all this sort of thing?
No, actually, I got out of most of the physical labor involved because I went overseas for a while it was being constructed.
Oh, I see.
I don't know exactly how it was done. The original design, I did almost entirely, the electrical design, I did almost entirely alone. But the mechanical design, just the physical construction of the thing, was done by McAllister, who was our mechanical engineer in the place. And I got all the major things sorted out at that time, and then Alec Little joined the group. Oh, no, he'd been working on that, sorry. He'd been working before. He did a lot of the test equipment development for it, that's right. And we were sort of working together on this. He was developing equipment to set it up while I was doing some of the basic design work. Then when we had it all figured out, I had this opportunity to go overseas for about 6 months. And at this stage, most of the bits had been made and assembly had been starting by a workshop at Fleurs Observatory. Well, it wasn't an observatory then, it was just a field, open field. And the actual setting up of it and the adjustment of it was Alec Little's responsibility. And he did a very good job on this. He, as I said, designed all the test equipment which were used for setting up the getting the currents right and phases right and things like that. We had discussed it all beforehand, and we had a pretty good idea of how it was going to work, but he was responsible actually for getting that all set up. When I came back, the thing was almost complete as far as I remember. There were still some adjustments to be made and things like that.
It must have been a pleasant sight.
No, it was a very pleasant sight.
What determined the overall size of the thing? Was it just the constraints on funds, or the size of the field, or was it something astrophysical?
Well, the astrophysical requirements set the minimum size of the thing. It had to be beyond about 1,000 feet, something of that order. The frequency was chosen on the basis of where we thought the maximum sensitivity for point sources would be. In fact, there's a bit of a discussion of that in a later paper in the astronomical issue of the Institute of Electrical Engineers, 58.
Oh, yes, that special issue.
Yes, that's right. There's a long discussion of the all
the
basic...
The American Proceedings of the IRA.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Right. And there's a long discussion of all the basic design factors which were considered and things like that. In that paper. We had a minimum size from the astrophysical requirements. The maximum size wasn't so much money, but the amount of effort we prepared to put into it. And I had originally hoped to have it a bit larger, something around about half a degree, but it became pared down a bit with time. who had finished up with something
49 art minutes.
Yes, 48 or 49 minutes.
This article.
Yeah.
But I don't quite follow you say the frequency was chosen for maximum sensitivity, and you were at 3.5 meters.
Yes.
But why not go to a lower frequency?
In that paper, I mentioned earlier, I have a discussion of this, and at the moment I can't quite remember what the various factors were.
Okay, well, I can
I think it may have been connected with, connected with resolution too, of course. So if you go to a lower frequency, it has to be larger, and you get a balance between resolution and sensitivity, particular frequencies, particular receivers,
right.
And round about. It's very wide maximum, around about 80 megahertz, well, it seemed to be about the right frequency to do it.
Were you thinking at all in these years that by observing only at very low frequencies that you might be biasing the nature of the objects you're finding, that there might be less than...
No, it was purely, let me see.
You pick up 800 megahertz or something?
Yes, it was. The sky would undoubtedly look different. We didn't at that time, I think. Seriously consider that there would be sources stronger at a high frequency than there were at a low frequency.
The torus was sort of puzzling.
It was more or less flat. It was flattish, but it was still everything we knew except for H2 regions was falling off at high frequencies.
Yeah.
And the reason we chose these, of course, was simply the receivers in those days, the high frequency receivers were very poor.
Can you tell me about your 6 month trip away from Australia? Where did you go?
This was spent in two places at Caltech, which was the basic reason for me going over to learn some basic astronomy, which I felt sadly in need of in those days, since I was really, Caltech was the centre,
right.
Of course, and this was the obvious place to go to talk to Minkowski and Varda, and I'd both been corresponding with both of these, and to look at the sky survey plates.
Which was in progress then?
Yes.
Now, when's this exactly?
This was in 53, about mid-53. It was shortly after publication of our first cross paper. And so I spent, from my point of view, this was a very fruitful part of my life. Could stop worrying about instrumental developments and sit down and start thinking about astronomy, astrophysics, and physics generally. And I spent about 3 or 4 months there, and another 3 months or so at the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism, which I looked on more as being in the nature of paying for my visit, since they were just becoming interested in radio astronomy, and I could, in fact, did help them out in a lot of technical matters. It was also very valuable, too, of course, to work in different groups.
This was Tube, was there?
Yes, Tube, well, too. Yes.
And was there anyone else that was...
Well, Graham Smith was overlapping me there. He
I
spent
see.
Some time.
Right, because he actually...
Overlap, yeah.
I guess you were the one that probably influenced him to build a cross, and I think Graham Smith actually finished it up.
It was... they had seen my paper before I came over, and had decided to go ahead and make a cross.
I see.
So that when I came over, in fact, they were already starting on this. And I didn't really contribute very much on the cross part at all.
I see.
The decision had already been made.
But I'm interested about your visit to Pasadena. I mean, can you tell me what Varda and Minkowski were thinking at that time and what they were teaching you, essentially?
Well, it was all colliding galaxies in those days, of course. And there were a lot of discussions about the probability of collisions and how many there should be, and there were some worries because there didn't seem to be enough collisions for the radio sources to observe. There was very little physics in that part of it. It was purely looking for abnormalities in the galaxies which might be identified with radio sources, but how the physical connection, no one had a clue about. The mechanism wasn't known then. I think I mentioned before that I'd had some suspicions that it was connected with synchrotron emission after reading Fermi's paper on the acceleration of cosmic rays, And there were one or two papers, Hank Hurlson had produced one.
Alfane and Hurlson and Kiepenhauer.
And Kiepenhauer, too. Although somehow I missed his. I didn't know how I missed Kiepenhauer's papers.
This was back in 1950.
Yeah.
And they were both in Phys Rev a couple months
ago. Yes, it was odd, but I was aware of the Alfane and Hurlson one, and I had a sort of feeling that this was probably the reason, but I didn't know enough astrophysics.
Did you know about the Russian work that was going on in 52 and 3?
No, I didn't strike that until later. I can't remember where I first struck that, but as soon as I saw this, everything clicked.
I see.
That was it.
You were a believer.
Yeah, I was a believer.
So it sounds like, from what you're saying, that Bottom and Kowski were really the only... Well, is that fair to say? Were they really the only two...
Yes, I think so. Yes, Al Greenstein had a bit of interest too.
Yeah.
But they were the two fundamental people. And as I said, we're all searching then to just...
And was Hubble still alive when you were there?
He
died in 1953,
I think. Yes, I met Hubble, actually, and had a short conversation with him when he died while I was in DTM, I think.
Was he going along with this, or was it just sort of outside?
He was interested in offhand, by the way. He wasn't professionally interested. Whereas Bartram and Kowski were really working hard on it and devoting all their efforts at that time to these problems. And we just didn't know. You see, it was a question then of, for instance, whether population 2 objects were connected with because of M87, an elliptical galaxy, and whether population 1, and
because of all the dust in Centaurus.
Yes, and this was one of the things which worried me, because I had this tendency towards thinking in terms of the synchrotron mechanism, just in the back of my mind, but it seemed to be M87 was the thing which really killed that, and also 5128.
Yeah, because it looks like such a tranquil galaxy.
Yes, yes. And 5128 also appeared to be an elliptical, so it looked as if these were elliptical galaxies, and in fact, as if these might be associated with the radiation and old stars.
Mm-hmm.
These were a lot of the things which we discussed at the time. And one of the first things I did with the cross when I was going, I can anticipate a little bit, was to look for emission in globular clusters, see if
that
problem could be resolved.
I see. Well, what about Henry Brown and Hauser's work on showing that spirals had strong continuum radiation?
Well, we knew the galaxy did, so this was...
Well, but M31, and then they began to pick up more and more spirals.
I can't remember the exact dates of these, but this picture was fairly clear that we had normal galaxies like the Milky Way, which we knew produced emission, M31 produced it, others you'd expect to produce it, but these were thought of as normal galaxies, and what we were worried about was this very abnormal emission.
Right, and were they beginning to be called radio galaxies then?
I think they probably were. I can't remember exactly when the term arose. You'd have to look through the literature to find that.
Well, this probably explains the source of your short article in Observatory in 54, in which entitled Abnormal Galaxies as Radio Sources. You talk about Fornax, and you say that, this is just from the abstract, I haven't looked at the paper, that 5128 may not really be colliding galaxies, and I guess that was just what you've been saying now, that you had this feeling.
Yes, this was written after I came back from my American visit, and after the cross had started working, and these were some of the first results, and I was working through some of the ideas which I had picked up in Pasadena. I can't really remember that particular paper. I know that it was written about that time, but I can't remember what was in it at all.
Do you think it's fair to say that the collision hypothesis was sort of grasped on because it didn't seem to be anywhere else to get such an amount of energy?
That was it, yes, certainly. And in fact, there was no doubt in 1953 between Bader and Kowski that they were dealing with colliding galaxies. And in fact, Kowski paid off a bet of a bottle of scotch to Varda as soon as they got the Spectrum of Cygnus.
Right,
you've probably
heard that
elsewhere, yeah.
When did they become converted on that story?
I can't remember the exact sequence, but it was more information that was coming in all the time. And I think, in fact, 1316 and 5128 did go a long way towards shaking them on this, because it was very difficult to really get a consistent colliding picture. And there was also another northern multiple source, which I can't remember which one it was now, in which Minkowski originally thought it was colliding, but then he found that several different velocity groups in it, and this looked very peculiar. I mean, you can have two velocities colliding. If you've got more, then it more suggests something.
Was this Percy saying?
Yes, it was. So that, I think that could have been...
We still don't understand what's going on.
That's true. But I think that was perhaps the first thing which shook Minkowski.
Now, but why do you say Centaurus didn't fit in? Because when you took a spectra, you didn't find two sets of lines. I don't remember in Centaurus where you were doing that.
The disposition of the lines, I think, didn't really suggest two separate colliding systems. I can't remember the details of it.
Okay, well, moving on. Short article on Observatory 56 on a radio source near the Galactic Center, which you apparently were interested in. What was the feeling about this radio source?
Well, there have been a number of papers produced by Patrick G. NRL had a Galactic Center source. So obviously this was something.
I think Bolton and somebody had a paper, didn't they, on the whole Galactic Center region where they mapped it?
Low resolution map, I think.
Yeah, I guess I guess you really wouldn't see the source.
No,
right.
It didn't show up at all. So we looked at it as a cross, and as soon as you look at it, you saw that you had one source right at the center, you had two sources straddling the high frequency source. And, well, this was obviously an intensely interesting result. And it was one of the few occasions, I think, where I sat down and wrote a paper very rapidly as soon as we had the contours worked out. Because it was clear that this non-thermal emission was arising on either side of the thermal emission. I didn't believe some of the distance analysis which has been made at the time, because it was obvious to me that this thermal source, which a high frequency people found, you couldn't really attribute the emission to it with any degree of certainty, because the baselines and base levels were so uncertain there.
Right.
And I felt that this must be at the center of the galaxy because everything was symmetrical. I went ahead on that basis.
But it just comes to me, there was a paper by, I think, Bolton and McGee on Sagittarius A. And I think it was about 53 or so. It was definitely earlier than 56.
Yes, that's right.
But I can't quite remember what it said.
I can't remember what it said either. I remember there was observations using a hole-in-the-ground type of antenna. Movable feed. I can't remember what it's
called. To check that.
But also, Piddington had done measurements of high frequencies.
That's right.
So the Galactic Center was an interesting thing. I mentioned Haddock and the NRL people, because at that time my work, they had the best observations.
At the high frequencies?
Yeah, high frequencies. But we had certainly, in the Australian group, there had been observations of it before then.
Right. So it sounds to me like in the mid-50s there was quite a bit of controversy then as to what the nature of this thing was. There were arguments that it was only 2 or 3 kiloparsecs away, and other arguments like yours.
As far as I remember, the short distance arguments did originate in the NRL group.
From H1?
And from H1.
Well, I guess that may have been a little bit later. But I think they had a distance even before they got the H1.
Yes, based on... I think it was by the ratio of the emission to the background or something like this. I can't remember the argument.
Okay, let's clean out a couple of these others before we get into the whole MSH survey and so forth. Absorption of 3.5 meter radiation in 6357, which is an H2 region.
Yes.
Which, according to the abstract, said it was the first ever seen absorption, but hadn't Ryle and Scheuer showed that the whole galactic plane absorbed 1523?
No, that was an inference, I think, rather than a direct observation. And the inference was actually wrong, because there were a large number of emission regions. In fact, this was the only absorption at 80 megahertz. That was the only obvious absorption
anywhere in the southern
along the Galactic Plane.
I see.
Eventually, we found others, but absorption sets in very much lower frequencies, of course, around 30 megahertz. So that in fact, was a source of one of the other sources of arguments between Cambridge and Sydney.
Well, I'm going to get Schroeder sometime this week. So
But you'd have to look at the original papers to sort that one out, because I can't remember the details.
And you, in fact, Mills, Little, and Sheridan in 1956, you published looking at 14 bright nebulae. I guess they were all these two regions.
Yes.
You detected six in emission and that one in absorption.
Yeah.
And you were deriving electron temperatures of 10,000 Kelvin. So it seems like you're really getting into astrophysics here.
Yes, we were, yes.
How did that come about? You didn't learn about H2 regions in Caltech, did you?
Oh, I learned about everything.
You learned about it?
Yes. I mean, I had also, of course, been reading astronomical literature. I think Caltech Pasadena visit was mainly a gelling of a lot of things, and maybe more of a feeding for the astrophysics of it.
Okay, now here's another paper in 1956, Mills, Little, and Sheridan, in which you looked at two supernovae and 10 novae, and only detected one supernova, namely Kepler's.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you make the suggestion that black and background make it to be integrated the integral of many supernovae remnants, which is a rather interesting comment. Were you thinking of these remnants as actually being the source of integrated particles, perhaps?
Yes, at that time it was the picture was simply that the supernova were going off, and what you were seeing was the integrated result of old remnants which had expanded.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say the picture. I don't think everyone accepted it. This is more the Russian line, tying in cosmic rays and background radiation.
I think around about that time, my outlook was quite close to the Russian line. As I said, I was very impressed with the Shklovsky work and interpretation of the Crab Nebula and things like this. And I think I was just generally thinking along similar lines.
Okay, here's another one on looking at bright galaxies in which you detected 10 and the Magellanic Clouds more than detected and mapped them out. And you made a model with a type 1 distribution. I guess I meant population one. And a spherical halo. So I guess this was under the influence of astronomy.
Yeah.
You'd learned also, but I mean about populations and.
Oh, yes. Yes, certainly. I was by then quite familiar with all the latest ideas in astronomy and astrophysics. There'd been a lot of work on populations and the formation of the stars in the early days of the galaxy. I remember Martin Schwarzschild was at Pasadena at that same time, and he was thinking of these things too, and there were numerous colloquia and so forth, which I attended. As I said, it was terribly fruitful. I learned all my astronomy in one
day. That was your graduate education in astronomy.
Exactly. It put me right in the forefront of thought at that time.
But were you thinking of the two the populations as being analogous to your class 1 and class 2?
No, I'm sorry. In this model,
no, that's not right.
I had the population 1 emission. There were supernovae and there were H2 regions and things like this. And there was also a halo thing which came directly from the observations. In the paper, you'll see some sections through the galaxy, which did suggest this. And this had been suggested by Shklovsky, of course, and I rather looked on this as confirming these observations, as confirming his picture of the more or less spherical halo.
Right.
But the population 1 component, he had attributed entirely to thermal emission in his model, and I think I pointed out that this was non-thermal as well as thermal.
I see. So are you saying that in the maps of these nearby bright galaxies you could actually see a hint of what we now call a disk and a halo?
No, I'm sorry. I could see that in the galaxy, in the Milky Way.
Right, and maybe the Magellanic Clouds?
The Magellanic Clouds, there was no evidence of a halo. When you plotted the emission, you found that the spirals, the SB spirals in particular, seem to have more emission than some of the earlier type galaxies. There seemed to be a maximum. You had irregulars like the Magellanic Clouds as low emissions. Radio to optical ratio was low. Things like the Milky Way and M31 and other normal spiral galaxies seemed to be high. When you got to ellipticals, it dropped right off again, except for the odd radio galaxies. So it appeared that this, again, the thought was dividing it into population 1 and population 2 objects.
Right.
And it did appear that you had to have a combination of them to produce the emission. I discussed this to some extent in my paper on the observation of normal galaxies.
And it was and then your observations of these other galaxies were consistent with this picture, but didn't really establish the picture.
Yeah. It appeared, in fact, that it could be you needed both mass and population 1. I think that was the suggestion I made to get radio emission in significant quantities.
You need mass.
Yeah. Well, that seemed to be the thing which correlated.
I
think you find that discussed in one of those
papers.
Well,
I must admit I haven't looked at that paper, so I'll have to do that. Well, we come along to Nielsen-Slee 57, which is the first installment of the MSH survey, which I guess was the main thing that you always had in mind to do with the Blue Cross. Or is that true? Is this your main idea to really do a super survey?
Yes, a survey.
But you had all these other projects along the side.
We're interested in the galactic structure and the survey in the beginning. And the survey, of course, takes more time. That's why the other ones came out first.
Right. And, well, can you tell me how this survey proceeded? Was it pretty straightforward?
Yes, just each night we did one strip of the sky and moved on the next night until interspersing this with observations of individual things which came out in the earlier papers. But the basic bread and butter work all the time, when it wasn't doing anything else, was on the survey.
Were there any ambiguities as to how this data should be reduced, or was that not interpreted on you, but reduced?
Well, there were lots of discussions as to what would be the best way of reducing it, and this was determined in the end, I think, by our facilities. But I don't think there was any real... we didn't consider two possible ways, and decide between them. It's just a matter of gradually working out what was the best thing to do.
Could you maybe just describe the procedure?
Right. Well, let me see if I can. We first set up, calibrated everything before the observation start, and there's noise diodes and things like this. We got an observational run through. If you look at the papers, you find that the actual records consisted of a series of interleaved observations at different declinations. And we then employed girls to trace these out and give us a series of scans at neighboring declinations. We had 5 beams at a time. You've got the actual, yes, here's a typical record.
Figure 1. Mm-hmm.
And actually, some of the other papers, earlier papers, showed it better with the going through the galaxy and things like this, which showed larger sources and so forth. But each of these scans on here, vertical lines, represents an integration, and the peak value of the scan represents the value of the integrated emission over that time. And we went, simply switched from one declination to the other over 5 declinations and back again, so that every 5th point there represents the emission at that declination. So we had to separate these out, and we did this with the aid of girls, being very cheap to employ in those days.
Right, and this is what you got in figure 2 then?
Yes, that's right, yeah. Then we looked through these, looking for bumps. This is basically what we did. Most times it was obvious, sometimes it wasn't. And there was the ones which were not obvious, which of course caused all the difficulties and problems.
Right. But, I mean, how did you handle them if it was not obvious? What were your criteria?
Let's begin with the obvious ones first. We draw a baseline under it. We get a deflection on different declinations and a time of maximum. Time of maximum would determine the RA, and by fitting these to a logarithmic, to an exponential beam,
right.
We had a little formula for doing that. The ratio between them would give the declination.
Right.
So we got our positions that way, and then we got the flux density by drawing a baseline underneath and measuring the deflection above that baseline. So that was the basic technique. And when we had troubles, when things were apparently extended, we know now that a lot of these extended ones were background irregularities. We thought at the time they might be, but we included all these in the catalogue because, again, we didn't know what we had to look for at that time. And any concentration of emission of any sort appeared to be worth cataloguing. And we were not necessarily thinking of cataloguing any point sources, but all concentrations.
Right. Once again, it was sort of an operational definition of a bump on the record.
Yeah, that's right. If the bump were extended, we would proceed in the same way and obtain an integrated flux density rather than just a deflection. And again, give a position and we'd give the ratio between the point and the integrated.
Did you think about trying to make a little contour map if it were extended?
We did think of it, and we, of course, did so in specific sources, but we didn't in our catalogues. It was just too much labour involved.
Yeah.
All this was manual reduction.
Right.
No computers available at all, of course.
No computers even up through the late 50s?
We didn't have any available to us. The one which had originally been developed in CSIRO, radio physics, which I mentioned earlier, was abandoned. It was decided that that wasn't an appropriate field for radio physics to deal with, and so that was sent away and we had none. Computers didn't become available in Sydney probably until about 54, but they weren't available to us then.
Now, these extended sources, of course, are critical to the whole argument. Were you thinking that a goodly number of extragalactic sources might well be extended also,
because
you were thinking population 2 and this sort of thing?
Well, it was obvious these could be either galactic or extragalactic, and we tended to think that most of the extended ones were probably extragalactic, and this is probably wrong. They were probably galactic, I would say. But in either way, of course, they must be included in any statistical analysis, or account must be taken of them because they're there.
Well,
and
something must be done about them.
Yeah, that's right.
One
could eliminate them entirely.
Yeah.
And but since one didn't know whether they were galactic or extragalactic,
right.
The reasonable thing to do is to do statistics on them and see how these statistics turned out. And see if that would indicate anything.
What we did. Were you worried at all about a blending of two point sources, essentially?
Yes. We knew that some of these would be blended sources, and we worked out the statistics of that.
How many could be?
And we found that there were many more. So we thought there may be extra blending. You see, at that time, we knew about radio galaxies. We knew there were clusters of galaxies. So we thought there was a distinct possibility that there would be physical associations between several radio sources. So we felt that a lot of these extended things, which, you see, our basic resolution was 3/4 degree, and we couldn't resolve very much. So we thought it was highly probable that some of these extended sources did in fact represent blends of radio galaxies.
Well, this survey began about when?
It would be 54, actually.
You talk about Posse going to the Jodrell Bank Symposium and appearing to contradict the Cambridge observations. Was that the first inkling that you had that things were looking rather different in the two surveys?
Yes, that was the first we heard of the Cambridge 2C survey, in the support of Causey.
And,
I don't know what, when was that, 55, yes.
Right. And was this a very small section of the total survey, which came out, you submitted it in late 56?
Yes.
Well, how did this come about? I mean, obviously, I can't quite remember. Did you see the published 2C catalog?
No, not at that time. I just remembered something.
Yes.
Actually, before we heard from Causey, I got a letter from Fred Hoyle asking, or mentioning, a very great excess of faint sources, which I have obtained at Cambridge, giving a slope of 3, minus 3, and asking what did we get. And we had rough results then. It was obviously, we couldn't possibly have a slope of minus 3, so I wrote back saying this.
Hmm.
And then this was formalised more in the other game, I suppose, in which Causey attempted.
I see.
But the first indication, I think, was a letter from Fred Hoyle.
I see. Do you think that letter could be dug
out? Doesn't exist, I'm sure. Well, it might be possible. I've got some old files there. I'll dig through them and
see
what
I've
got.
I don't. But anyway, so that was your first indication that you were getting rather different results.
Yeah.
And how were you able to make the detailed comparison? Did you have that before publication?
I think Causey organized this while he was over there. They sent over a section of their catalog, and we reduced. I'm not sure how this was organized, whether I had actually told Causey, well, we've nearly reduced this area, see if you can get something on that. I think that's actually what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, we had this result. And
so he brought this, it wasn't published yet, he brought...
Ryle may have sent, I can't remember, but we certainly had it before. It had been submitted at that time. It was all the work was complete. It was just a matter of sending us a sort of preprint of the thing.
And what did you think when you had a few hours to look at this?
Well, it was obvious that Cambridge were not listing radio sources as such. Because one could look, one could take an area where there were some quite strong sources in the Cambridge catalogue, look at our records, and see that there was absolutely nothing there. And so it had to be explained. I was already quite familiar with the effects of resolution then. So the explanation is obvious. Did a bit of simple figuring on the beam areas available, and it was clear that they were listing about one source per beam area.
Right, which you point out in this paper, of course. You explicitly show the 2 degree by 15 degree Cambridge beam, and you're 1 degree beam approximately. But you say it was obvious, but how did Cambridge group go wrong, would you say?
I really cannot understand that. I mean, they knew about the resolution problem, I'm quite sure, at that stage. In fact, I had discussed this with Graham Smith way back in 52. How they could possibly have interpreted their records as being isolated, discrete sources, I simply cannot understand.
Hmm.
You ask them.
Well, I have, but I'm trying to get opinions all around. I don't know, maybe it was something to do with just sort of a hunger for a great number of sources to do catalogy
or
something.
That could be. Yes.
There's more in science than science sometimes.
Yes, if one has some preconceived idea, then an observation which apparently confirms it will often be accepted without great criticism.
But I don't think that's fair to say that there was a preconceived idea, because it's my understanding that when Cygnus came along, well, I should ask you before I say what I was going to say. When you started off on this survey, were you interested in cosmology? Did you see this as something useful that you have a survey?
Not when I started on the first one. That's 51 survey.
Not that one, right.
By then I knew that one had a chance of being cosmology, and I certainly knew that.
But what was the reasoning of that?
Well, they were distant. You were dealing with distant sources, and they were at cosmological distances. The identifications showed that they were very, very faint things, and that strong sources were very faint, optical objects, so obviously it was relevant to cosmology. I mean, we all knew that.
The Cygnus identification really...
Yeah, the Cygnus one...
was the key to it being weakest optically in this.
But on the other hand, we knew that 5128 and M87 probably wouldn't have very much cosmological interest. And it was just this appreciation that there was undoubtedly a very wide luminosity function.
Okay, so that when you started the MSH survey, then you were thinking that it would have a cosmological use.
That it could.
That it could, right.
I wasn't, I didn't have any ideas that it would turn out to have such an enormous cosmological impact in the Cambridge viewpoint.
But did you actually sit down beforehand in terms of the design of the survey at all and say, now, in order to test this cosmology
No, not at all.
How many sources?
Not at all. Yeah. No, it was the design of the instrument and the planning of the observations was based on what we had observed before in the radio sky in Tai.
Okay, so that I guess you felt compelled to come out with this short part of the survey.
Yeah, we did. We had some correspondence about this, and Rao was quite unshakable. And I know Pawsey had argued with him about this, and his opinion was that Rao, again, was quite unshakable. And what... So we felt the only thing to do was to do a thorough analysis as far as we could, comparing the two catalogues as being the only way of sort of bringing things to a head and establishing.
Any of that correspondence would be extremely interesting to.
Yes,
that could be located.
I can't. I'll see if I can dig anything out. But I, as far as I remember it, my efforts were met with no reply. I remember sending one letter to Ryle, for instance, saying, well, now, here are our records of this area where you have these sources shown.
Yeah.
There are no sources there. And could it be resolution effects or something like this? Mm-hmm. And I never got an answer. We were a bit fed up with the Cambridge attitude at this time, I might say. And
it comes through in this paper. I mean.
Yeah. They just ignored us, and so we went ahead and did what we thought had to be done.
Well, related to an earlier question I had, do you think it possible that if you'd been working at Oxford, that this could have gotten straightened out? I mean,
I think it probably could.
That it was really this.
Although I think Donald Bank had difficulties straightening things out with Cambridge too. So.
Well, they never inflicted so much on direct observational things.
This was a... I'm sure if we had been able to take our records along and put them down on the table, look at their records...
Well, but now someone has told me that... I think David Edge told me that you actually came up and did this, I guess in connection to the 58 symposium.
Oh, yes, that was later. Yes, we did that then. At this stage, our results were, as far as we could determine, just completely dismissed by Cambridge. Mm. So we had no alternative but to come out with this sort of a paper, which...
I think of it, what was the result of when you finally did get up and were able to lay your records out, I guess...
Oh, I think by then the Cambridge people were fighting a rear guard action on the 2C survey and were starting off on the 3C.
Right.
And I think they appreciated the detailed criticisms. I'm sure that they had all abandoned it by then.
Yeah. So this was mainly to look at 3C.
That's right.
Well, as you've already hinted at, this paper doesn't mince words here. It is found that the surveys are almost completely discordant, and a couple other good quotes in here.
Yeah.
I don't seem to be able to find them now. But the paper largely seems, rather than talking, I mean, my fear in saying that, rather than talking about your survey, and you do analysis of it and so forth, but rather you're really, it's much more emphasized towards showing that 2C is wrong.
Well, this was necessary at the time, I think, because there was an enormous publicity attendant on the